Good morning, everybody. We are going to call our meeting for February 7th to order. It is 9:01. All right, let's get started with our non-agenda public comment. Just a quick reminder, any member of the public who wishes to address the Housing Commission has to complete a speaker request form. Speakers are limited to 3 minutes each. Collective testimony by those who support or oppose an item will be limited to no more than 15 minutes total per side. Non-agenda public comments will be heard at the beginning of each meeting. We're getting to that in just a second. Those who wish to address the board about a topic that is not on the agenda must fill out a white speaker request form. Members of the public who may request to have an item pulled from the consent agenda by submitting a speaker request form prior to the start of the meeting. To speak on a matter on the agenda, members of the public must complete a speaker request form and submit it to the recording secretary before the item is called. If you wish to speak in opposition to the item, we ask that you complete a pink form. If you are in favor, please complete a gold form. With that, nobody rushing to the speaker slips, we're going to move into non-agenda public comment, which we have one. I'd like to welcome Martha Welch up to the front. Good morning.
Good morning, Martha Welch. Now you can't opt out and get money for the federal or state. They're mad at you. I found out what happens SSD for bribes, and that's how it started. Right now, I know it goes on in San Diego with student housing. We only have senior buildings in HUD. Now, that's not right. And you know who's living there? Chinese don't pay the rent. I've proved that, and that's why the federal and state, they know nothing happens if you come here and look. I look, that's the problem, I look. Now, when you build something like COM 2, build it three times, and path, connection, you do that all the time, you build something twice. Now the Metro, they moved to Alpha Square, but they changed it up. If they never got the money from you, so they finally opened up and that's renting. This is, goes on, you expect a Bill Horn, or William is really named, to call. He can't call anymore. He's in the hands of the federal government, I believe he is, he's in a lot of trouble. And now the housing, what are they going to do? Because they haven't financial audits. You have to do that. And you haven't done it for years. And now you haven't built the right thing. You don't build anything for families. You two bedrooms, you don't build any of those right here. I live in Celadon. They're mostly studios. And right next to me is a family living in the studio. That's right. That's what goes on here. Because it's only building for everybody. It's not really HUD. You get 2 years on property that. And then you go Section 8. That's how you get Section 8 here, the building, really. You don't answer the phone all the time and call back and things like that. You don't work with the people. You're against it. It's like you turned against us in the housing and the government right here. You might have free rent like the Chinese do. It's a mirror what they do. And maybe you got SSD and don't do your taxes. This has gone on for a long time. And I cracked the case. I'm proud to do it. I have a lot of people in resistance. That's why they lost Medi-Cal, food stamps, and SSD. They lost it because and now they're looking at everybody who took these bribes. The full force. They're here. The full force of the government is back here. Full force because what you did here. You don't build the right things. And housing doesn't build anything. If you look around, they haven't built much. They do rehab buildings and they expect you to pay them for doing that privilege. And all these rules you have with housing and everything, you don't have to pay any attention to it because you can't call. You think he'd be nice and not call? That's impossible. He just can't call because he's in a situation where he's in trouble outside of San Diego. Because I've been working since 2015 investigating. I know what everything goes on here. I'm not afraid to look. I look. I go everywhere and I look and I look at a lot of things. And you don't have insurance, probably like the city doesn't have insurance. You have a lawsuit or something like that. And you don't follow the law all the time here either. I don't think you do the right thing because it's this build. We have all these empty buildings here that were built, and it's a ghost town, really, and we didn't build the right thing.
Ms. Welch, one concluding sentence,
okay,
please.
Okay, thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. We're going to move into commissioner comments. I do have a few regarding some of our new commissioners and our recognition of former commissioners. But before I do that, do any other commissioners have any comments? Not the new, any commissioner, really.
Yeah. I normally don't make commissioner comments because we usually have a lot of business to get through, and I'd rather cut straight to that. But we have a light agenda, and it's been an interesting month, so I think I'm going to say a couple things. One, the past month has been interesting from the larger housing policy perspective. We saw SB 50 go down. The debate around new revenue measures is heating up. And there was one thing that happened that was a bit of a silver lining to all of this, and I'd like to thank staff. Jeff very quickly pulled together. I don't know who else was involved, but a few months ago, we approved the Mount Etna project, and last week, I got a message that it was up at Planning Commission and that there was a big push to cut 90 units off of the project. And this is actually the closest project we've approved to my neighborhood, so I have kind of a special interest. So I went down to the Planning Commission, and the debate that was taking place, the criticism from my neighbors, unfortunately, was that Claremont has too much affordable housing already, and the term dumping ground was used. And unfortunately, no one really had any numbers about exactly where affordable housing was distributed, how Claremont compared to other places. And I was very, very happy that in the matter of 5 minutes, the Housing Commission staff was able to shoot over the numbers. And it turned out that in 92117, which is where the Mount Etna project is approved, there's only 74 units of affordable housing, and that makes it rank number 27 out of 32 zip codes in the city that have affordable housing. And that seemed like it was a really important factor for the Planning Commission. So that was great to add some clarity so that these questions aren't just answered based on gut feelings or people's sense of what their community looks like or should look like, that there's some real facts behind it. So I want to thank staff for pulling that together, and I think that those numbers are going to be really helpful for a wide number of things. And then the second thing that was encouraging about that hearing was that the Planning Commission, for the first time I've seen, made it very clear that they were now viewing affordable housing review in the context of the housing crisis that we're in. And on this project, some of the comments were along the lines of, if this were not an affordable housing project, we may be going a different direction with this. A couple of years ago, we may have gone a different direction with this, but they made it very, very clear that they would not be removing units from any affordable housing project going forward. And I thought that was a huge win because, you know, this agency does a great job with what we handle, these financials that come before us every month and making the most out of the resources that we have. But it can be frustrating when things leave our purview, go somewhere else, and all of a sudden you have things getting chopped down, removed, undone. And so to see other agencies step up and have a more unified front on the issue of we are going to have more affordable housing, and specifically that we're not going to engage in this discussion about viewing affordable housing as a burden. I think that's another thing that we've seen a lot of progress on even just in the last few months, is the discussion around affordable housing needs to be that this is a benefit and an asset to these communities, that what has made Claremont a great community for the last 60 years has been the fact that it has accommodated a wide array of incomes. And that's increasingly not the case anymore. And so that these projects, this is not a question of who's shouldering their burden. This is a question of, you know, who gets the benefit of these resources and this housing that can accommodate people who otherwise wouldn't be able to live there. So I just, again, wanted to thank staff and also, you know, just as there's victories and setbacks in the housing policy debate, it is nice to see that there's some progress, however small, on a lot of different fronts. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Kloepner. Points well taken. Any other commissioner comments? Commissioner Hester? No? Okay. I'm going to move into welcoming our new commissioners, and I'm very excited to welcome Mitch Mitchell, the Vice President of State Governmental Affairs and External Affairs for San Diego Gas and Electric, otherwise known as SDG&E, and Southern California Gas Company, as well as Mr. Dion Akers, the Assistant Director of Strategic Partnerships for San Diego State University, SDSU. Commissioners Mitchell and Akers were appointed by Mayor Kevin Faulkner and confirmed by the San Diego City Council during its meeting this past Tuesday. We look forward very much to working with both of you and to the experience and perspectives you'll bring to this board. I know that this board has been increasingly exciting in recent years, and I'm sure we have a very robust future ahead of us, and we look forward to your participation. It's very nice to have you. Before we move into recognition of former commissioners, do either of you have any opening comments? No? No pressure? Now it's pretty. Okay.
Well, first of all, I want to say it's a pleasure to be here to join this body. And I know this is a big topic of conversation. There's a lot of work to do. There's a lot of things to think about on how to do it better. And Rick and I have had several conversations about this. I'm excited about the opportunity. So thank you very much for welcoming me.
Thank you for the nice comments. Thank you for having us. In reviewing the annual report, there's a section from the Housing Commission of list of former commissioners. It is a veritable who's list of community leaders, individuals who made a wonderful impact in this city and in this region. I feel humbled and honored to be here. It's a great time to be tackling these issues. It's a very important work that we're doing here. Let's get to work.
Thank you very much. And with our new faces, we also have the opportunity to celebrate somebody who has departed our commission. Two individuals, in fact, but one here today who I am pleased to recognize, Mr. Tim Walsh. Tim and I actually joined the board at the same time back in April 2017, and I have since been very envious of his eloquence and ability to phrase the tough questions well. So we do miss him already, but Commissioner Walsh distinguished himself early throughout his more than 2 years on the board. He served on the board's Real Estate Committee and Strategic Plan Committee, which provided valuable insight and guidance for the agency's strategic plan. In addition, he served as a member of the Board of Directors at the Housing Commission's nonprofit affiliate, Housing Development Partners, where he brought that same gusto. I'd like to invite Commissioner Walsh to come forward to receive an award in appreciation of his leadership and public service with the Housing Commission. We also want to thank and recognize a commissioner who couldn't be with us today. I believe he's traveling, former commissioner, Mr. Frank Ertassin. He's not able to join us, but we do want to take a moment to acknowledge his leadership on this board. Commissioner Ertassin was on the board for more than 7 years, including 2 years as chair. Over the years, he was on the board's strategic plan, real estate and investment committees, and he recommended in 2014 to expand the Housing Commission's strategic plan to address the construction costs of affordable housing, which is something we are still very much looking at today. Specifically, he sought to ensure cost-efficient business practices were being used and cost efficiency became the emphasis of a new objective in the strategic plan. Thank you to Commissioner Ertassin for his leadership and public service to the Housing Commission. Okay, and now we'll move into the report by the President and Chief Executive Officer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning. First of all, my thanks to Vice Chair Klumner for his kind remarks. Very much appreciate that. And Jeff, to you and your folks for being so quickly responsive, thank you. Ryan, I was always taught that a good CEO hires people smarter than he or she is. And some would say for me that's a low bar. But nonetheless, I've got the strongest staff here I've ever worked with in my career. Jeff and all the rest, it's a good crew. And thank you for pointing that out. I very much do appreciate it. Jeff, thank you. I also have four items just of note that I'd like to point out for the record since the last meeting of this board. The first is that last week on January the 30th, I was in Sacramento. I had the honor to meet with Governor Newsom's three of his senior counselors. One is the Deputy Legislative Secretary, one the Deputy Legal Affairs Secretary, and the other, the chief of the Housing, Homelessness, and Civil Rights Branch of the Cal Department of Social Services. These three people are going to be in a leadership role in helping the governor decide some of his additional housing policies going forward. These folks were impressed with the Housing Commission's Homelessness Action Plan, our Housing First San Diego effort that we launched some 5.5 almost years ago, and our successes since then. And I'll point out again that, and thank you to Lisa Jones for your great leadership in this arena as well. At this point, since we launched Housing First San Diego in November of 2014, we have provided some 8,600 families with housing opportunities. That means we've either gotten them off the streets or helped them to avoid the streets over the last 5.5 years. And in that same time period, I'll point out that we are the only major municipality on the West Coast that's not seen a profound spike in the number of homeless on the streets. I'm not saying we've solved the problem. Only a fool would say that. And I'm not saying we don't have a whole lot more work to go. But what we've done so far, I think, has been of note. And the governor's staff did recognize that. I will point out as well that the steering committee dealing with additional homeless planning efforts had its first meeting this week. That included Mayor Faulkner, Councilmember Ward, who's also the president of the Regional Task Force on Homelessness, Nathan Fletcher from the county, as well as other leaders in the city who are helping us, helping the Housing Commission as we continue our homelessness efforts going forward. It is focusing nicely right now. Different matter, on January the 21st, I was pleased to attend a groundbreaking ceremony for a Housing Commission partnership in the East Village that will provide some 403 affordable apartments. Of these, 270 will be for San Diegans experiencing homelessness. This was the groundbreaking for the St. Teresa of Calcutta Villa property, named after Mother Teresa. That is being done by Father Joe's Villages, with Chelsea Investment Corporation as the developer. I'd like to thank Chair Benvenuto, who was present speaking at the event, representing the Housing Commission. And I'll point out that this in this particular development, the Housing Commission has invested some $11.5 million in loans through the agency's Homelessness Action Plan, again, Housing First San Diego. And also, the Housing Commission has awarded some 270 housing vouchers, federal housing vouchers, to help these formerly homeless people pay their rent. We also, in addition, issued $123 million in multifamily housing revenue bonds. This is a huge property, as properties go in this era. 403 units is the largest we've done since I've been here in one fell swoop. And so this will make a big difference in the city and in East Village. I know that during our presentation this morning, I've asked Colin Miller also for the newer board members to give a little bit of a high-level explanation of how this program works and then get into approving the item that's before you this morning. But this is one of the better programs around that helps to provide permanent supportive housing for the homeless going forward. Also, two other homelessness items to draw your attention to. One is on January the 23rd. The We All Count annual point in time event occurred. There were more than 1,700 volunteers participating in this point in time effort throughout the county during the early morning hours of January the 23rd. There was a wonderful turnout of leadership from this organization at that count. It included Vice Chair Klumpner, Commissioners Davis, Hester, Hubbard, and I were among the volunteers who helped to count and survey individuals experiencing homelessness. We were joined by too many other dignitaries from your list right now, but it was a good event and a good turnout. This homelessness census, if you will, is essential in securing the millions of dollars in federal continuum of care funding that come from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development for local homelessness programs each year. This current year, the amount of funding that came to the city and county combined, the total area was in excess of $20 million. Of that, just under $5 million came to this organization, to the Housing Commission, which helps to fund our program. So this is an essential activity. Also, Madam Chair, in closing, I'd like to draw the board's attention to another event that will occur later this month on February the 26th. And this is the 14th annual Project Homeless Connect for downtown San Diego. And Project Homeless Connect is a fair, if you will, for those San Diegans who are homeless. It will occur at Golden Hall at the San Diego Concourse from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. on February the 26th. And this is, of the 14 years this has been in existence, this is the 10th consecutive year that the Housing Commission has served as the lead organizer. Our major organizing partners include the City of San Diego, Interfaith Shelter Network, Family Health Centers of San Diego, Father Joe's Villages, the County of San Diego. And Project Homeless Connect provides individuals with access to a variety of services to help connect them to permanent housing opportunities and addresses other immediate needs such as health screenings, flu vaccines, dental exams, haircuts, legal aid, pet care, and other services. I would encourage the board, as you can and if you can, to stop by and participate in this housing homelessness fair on February the 26th. And with that, Madam Chair, that concludes my report.
Thank you, Mr. Gentry. We'll move on to approval of the minutes for the January 10th meeting. Do we have a motion? Okay. We had a motion by Commissioner Hubbard, seconded by Commissioner Hester. All those in favor? Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Next, we'll move to adoption of the consent agenda. We have one item on consent, item 100. Do we have a motion for the consent agenda? Moved by Commissioner Davis. Seconded by Commissioner Hubbard. All those in favor? Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Moving on to item 101, the fiscal year 2021 moving to work annual plan approval. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Benvenuto, Commissioners, Mr. Gentry, Mr. Christensen. I'm Saket Thayal, Senior Vice President of Strategic Operations and Policy. I'm here with Mariangela Petruno, our Moving to Work Program Administrator. We're here to seek approval for our FY 2021 Moving to Work Annual Plan. Maybe not. I'm going to go ahead and get started. The first slide is just listing the agenda. So we're going to go ahead and start by discussing the Moving to Work program. I do acknowledge our new commissioner, so we'll do a little bit of a Moving to Work 101. And then Mariangela will share our proposed initiatives for the 2021 plan, and we'll open it up for feedback. Perfect. That works. So we're on slide 3, and we'll catch up. So Moving to Work is a federal demonstration program. It started in 1996. San Diego was one of the original housing authorities selected, but initially did not pursue it and opted out in 2004. 2008, fast forward, Mr. Gentry became our CEO, and San Diego then opted back into the Moving to Work program. We are part of an elite group. There are only 39 agencies that have this flexibility, and there are about 3,400 housing authorities across the nation. In 2015, Congress did recognize the power of Moving to Work and authorized HUD to expand the program by 100 agencies over the next 7 years. So what is MTW? MTW is a license to be creative. We call ourselves America's Housing Policy Lab. We are able to design and develop initiatives that either improve the current processes or help address our local issues. The caveat, it has to meet one of these statutory objectives that HUD has. The first one deals with streamlining. So there are many archaic processes in place. A recertification could take 35 steps. As a Moving to Work agency, you could take a look at that, do a Kaizen on it, and do it in 10, do it in 20. As long as you're meeting the same objective, HUD will go ahead and approve it. The second supports improving housing opportunities for our families. And the third is helping our families on their path to economic independence. On an annual basis, we propose initiatives in the annual plan, like we're doing today, and report on the initiatives and the metrics in our annual report. I believe what differentiates us from other moving to work agencies is the fact that we've embraced it 100%. Many agencies focus only on achieving greater cost effectiveness, and they're not fully maximizing on the flexibility of moving to work. MTW at San Diego spans across all and the entire agency and all of our programs. We've used the flexibility to simplify cumbersome processes. In development, we've used it to create and preserve affordable housing. And more recently, to address homelessness, we've developed a lot of programs that are addressing the local issue. One of the handouts is a list of moving to work initiatives, and it's a good example on that is the Guardian Scholars Program. We worked with Commissioner Akers to develop a program that's very boutique and very special to San Diego State University. I could talk about all of them in a perfect world, but we'll be here all day. So we're going to focus on just one, which is very unique and boutique to San Diego as well. It's the Path to Success program, and that also should be a handout. So Path to Success changes the way we calculate the portion of rent that our families pay. I'm going to talk first how a traditional program works. So traditionally, a program pays, a family pays 30% of their income. So if I make $1,000 a month, my portion would be about 30%, which is $300. And then there's some deductions and allowances, but we're not going to get into that. Also in a traditional program, HUD defines a family by the person who holds the voucher. We changed both in Path to Success. First, we divided our families into two groups, work-able and elderly disabled. Let's define a work-able family. So a work-able family is a family where any one adult in the household is under the age of 55, not disabled, and not a full-time student between the ages of 18 to 23. So conversely, for to be an elderly disabled family, every adult member is over the age of 55 and or the adults are disabled or a full-time student between ages of 18 and 23. Just to draw a difference between this and a traditional program, so you have a 65-year-old parent living with their 30-year-old kid. In this case, if HUD was to look at the family, HUD would say this is an elderly disabled family. In our case, it's a work-able family because we do recognize the 30-year-old fits the work-able criteria. We changed the calculation. For our elderly disabled families, we lowered it from 30 to 28.5%. We streamlined some of the deductions and allowances, and we lowered the minimum rent. HUD's minimum rent was $50. We lowered it to $0. For our work-able families, also streamlined the deductions and calculations, and we created income bands. So let me explain that. So the bands that San Diego Housing Commission has created are $5,000. Now, in a traditional program, let's say I make $24,000, and I get a small raise, and that takes me now to $25,000 a year. The first thing I have to do is come back to my housing authority and report that small increase. The housing authority will then take that number, redo the whole calculation, and come up with a new number that you now have to pay. We believe this disincentivizes families to get raises or to work harder to get a little bit of a bump, because in their back of their minds, they're seeing, if I make more money, right away I got to go through all these other steps, and it's going to change the portion that I pay. So we created our income bands, which are $5,000. We use the lower number of the tier for the calculations. If this family was on our program, making $24,000, they get to $25,000, no problem. The portion that they pay does not change until their next recertification. Another significant change is the minimum rent. I mentioned earlier the traditional minimum rent is $50. In ours, we changed our minimum rent for our work-able families on the basis of one work-able member or two work-able members. So back in 2013, if you had one work-able member, your minimum rent was $200. And if you had two, it's $350. 2 years later, in 2015, we changed that to $300 and $500. And then just recently, on January 1st, 2020, we changed that to $400 and $650. These numbers were based on California's minimum wage, and the increase reflects the increase to California's minimum wage. An important point to note is before we implemented Path to Success, we set up our Achievement Academy. Now, the Achievement Academy is a learning and resource center and computer lab located right here on the first floor. Its programs emphasize career planning, job skills, personal financial education, and they help individuals become more and more self-reliant. All of our families are teamed up with a workforce readiness specialist, and this is their one-on-one coach, mentor, guidance. Through the Achievement Academy, many motivated clients have secured employment, increased their earnings, and started their own businesses. want to share some quick stats on our fiscal year 2019. So in FY 2019, there were over 2,000 individuals that were served through the Achievement Academy. Around 1,200 of them enrolled in the core services. 328 were placed in new jobs, and 414 increased their wages. Achievement Academy really empowers our family. I'm going to stop there for a minute. There's a lot of information. If you have any questions, you can ask now. We also have choice for questions later on. But any immediate questions?
It's okay. Let me point out one other thing, too, if my memory is correct. Since we've implemented this program in 2013, my recollection is the average income, the average reported income of our work-able families has gone up something like 35%.
That's correct.
Because now there are incentives to go to work if you're able to, and protections if you cannot.
Correct. We do have a hardship policy for families that may not be able to do it. So with that, I'm going to pass it on to Maria Angela, and she's going to talk about the initiatives we have for this year's plan.
Okay, this year we're proposing two new initiatives. The first initiative is to establish the reasonable cost limits that better reflect our housing production costs. And the second activity we're proposing is the preservation of affordable housing in the city of San Diego. Every year, HUD publishes tables that detail each metropolitan area's total development cost limits. And we use these cost limits to determine the funding that can be used in the development and rehabilitation that a project requires. However, HUD's published rates have not kept up with the actual development costs that we have seen in the city of San Diego. So the Housing Commission conducted an analysis of several years' worth of developments and aligned them with HUD's current construction categories, such as elevators or walk-ups. This analysis determined the average total development and hard construction costs per square foot. Using this as a baseline, we have developed an updated table of cost limits, which you can see in the presentation. I would like to use an example of the two-bedroom TDC. Our estimate for a walk-up is $370,000, which is a 51% increase over HUD's published number of $245,000. Still on there. Projects use lasagna financing in their pro forma, and these new TDC limits would allow us to provide needed funding to the Housing Commission projects using variable sources. This initiative would meet the Moving to Work statutory objective by increasing the housing choice for low-income families as additional rental housing can be developed. The second new Moving to Work initiative that we're proposing this year is the development of affordable housing preservation assistance. This is addressing the shortage of affordable housing in the city of San Diego, and it requires both the creation of new housing units and the preservation of existing affordable housing units. The Housing Commission is seeking to develop methods of financing for the preservation and rehabilitation of properties that are not owned by the Housing Commission. This initiative will provide us flexibility to work with landlords who seek funding for preservation or rehabilitation of their properties. We have seen this situation recently when the board approved the J Street Inn project, and this will allow us more tools to extend affordability and prevent displacement of affordable housing families. The Housing Commission is committed to developing methods of financing to ensure that properties receiving this funding will remain affordable for the foreseeable future for families earning up to 80% of the area median income. And this concludes our presentation, and if there's any questions or comments, we are here to take them.
Obviously, there's a lot for me to learn in this, that's what I'm excited about on this topic. On the housing, on the low-income housing preservation component, I read that and I was intrigued by that. What that statement indicates or points to is that you have a set number of units that are considered low-income, available for low-income families, and that you're going to preserve that number and try and grow that number. Is that a fair statement?
More preserve, trying to grow it from a development perspective. Mr. Gentry has a comment.
Let me step back and go about 30,000 feet higher.
Okay.
There. This is one of our programs only, and that's our biggest program. Mm-hmm. In fact, with the increase in payment standard and subsidies we got approved by HUD about a year ago, this is going to be about $170 million per year subsidy program and over the next, by next year, if my memory is correct.
Okay.
As we've implemented the move into work plan, if you remember, one of the three criteria was to expand housing opportunities. So if we're able to create efficiencies and to create retained earnings, then we can take those retained earnings and plow them back into the business in other places. And we've done that in any number of ways. If you look at Hotel Churchill right out the window here,
yes,
we own that. The Housing Commission owns that. And that was refurbished. It was about a $20 million budget, if my memory is correct. And about half of that we included as retained earnings from the Move Into Work program that went straight into it. We've also used that program to acquire properties otherwise, which we'll do a workshop on all this stuff in another month or two. And for the newbies, anytime you'd like to sit down and talk about this in depth, we'll do it with you. But the thing to look at this program, this is only one of a whole menu of opportunities we have to serve our customer base. And because we can create retained earnings here, we can use it in other places. Now, what we're adding, now, it's not quite a block grant from HUD, and it's not quite deregulated. We've got to get them to approve what we do every year. And so we add to our portfolio options every year additional stuff. One of the things we're adding this year is to use the retained earnings to deal with preservation broader in the community. And that dovetails nicely in with a policy we're working on right now at the direction of Council President Gomez, which is called preservation. And preservation refers globally not just to what the Housing Commission owns and operates, but what is in the entire community, because their housing is fragmented, and affordable housing is fragmented. And there are properties out there that have been subsidized in various forms through the years, some of which we've done and some of which we've had nothing to do with. There hasn't even been a database of all of it until what we're putting together right now, which we should have out in draft form later this month and to you all for consideration and the Housing Commission for our Housing Authority for consideration later this fiscal year. So what I'm giving you is a long-winded, verbose answer, but is to take this particular program, which is one of our cores and very important, and put it in the context of how we're trying to leverage federal monies, use them efficiently, then use them beyond their ordinary scope to help the community as well by saving other properties.
I appreciate that that explanation. I think one of the things that is going to be really important for me in this conversation that we're going to have and the things that we're going to work on is the clarity, because in all the social service organizations that I deal with, there's confusion over this space. And so when you say preservation, I in my mind, I hear we have 4,000 units that qualify now, and we're going to preserve those 4,000. We're going to make sure that they're there year after year, that they're there. And so that's good. I would ask two other questions on this, which is, one of the things that we've found in San Diego and throughout California is that the rent hikes have often led to the scrambling of families. There's now a new law that prevents rent hikes from exceeding a certain amount. So how does that calculate into this program, A? And then B, I was intrigued by the HUD comments, and all the markets that HUD governs are all different. So do they make adjustments based on California's market is far different than everybody else's. We've had this debate in San Diego for years with the Department of Defense, for instance, and the basic allowance for housing that they provide for military families. It's completely inadequate because the market here is so much higher than it is in middle of the country, Mississippi, other areas where there are military installations. Does HUD adjust? Their view and how they look at San Diego, does it reflect that our market is completely different than other markets? And do they adjust based on that analysis, or do they just say, hey, here's the number, everybody's got to be guided by this?
I'm going to give you an equivocal answer, and I'm going to ask Suquette, if I misstate this, to please correct me. First, let's deal with the rent gouging bill, 1482. And that one does not apply to housing that receives subsidies. And there is some debate at the state level of whether it does or doesn't, but our council believes that it clearly does apply, and so do councils of other agencies. And so unless the law changes, that's kind of where we are. it applies, it doesn't apply where their subsidies go, then there's not a market base in the first place. How HUD looks at things, Lord only knows. There are adjustments to rent subsidies based on economic data throughout the nation. And so, let's say the voucher subsidies for in San Diego per unit are far higher than where I started my career in Greensboro, North Carolina. And they reflect market differences and variables. Now, within that, though, there's a lot of HUD standardized approaches to doing business. Except, since we're moving to work, we can get an exception to that as we see we need it for our local area. So, it's a flux.
Flux. I think it's a frustration that I feared because, again, I think that the proper view of our market, you know, is it to take the market for what it really is. And, you know, I was born here in California, but I grew up in Oklahoma, and Oklahoma is known as the state where you can work at the mall and still buy a home. It's a great thing. That's not the case here. And when it comes to rents and subsidies and HUD's one size fits all approach, that's a concern. And it's one of those things that hopefully we can discuss. We may need help from our friends in the delegation to say, this has to stop. Because it doesn't work.
And I think your points are well taken. The fact that we're moving to work makes a huge difference here. And it's the only reason I came back into the public sector 12 years ago to come back in here was to get that kind of flexibility. I'll point out that what I think is a major issue that is of about 40 years duration now, most of my career, that's affected negatively housing markets, is you've not seen an appreciable increase in the level of federal involvement since the mid-1990s. And there's not been a great involvement since the early 1980s. Now, we could make this a non-quick board meeting if you want to, but I doubt that we want to have that discussion now. But over time, there are a lot of forces and influences that affect this industry, and there's not just one. You heard the term lasagna financing a while ago used, and that was one of my terms. And that reflects the way typically housing, tax credit housing in particular, which is the biggest driver of affordable housing development now, is developed. And that is, instead of one source of subsidy, one hunk of meat, if you will, you got to layer in your money. That makes it a little, but still be pretty tasty if you get your layers right. But a lot of what we do, that's also given us a lot of criticism in the community, is people say, well, we sit on money. That's not true. People don't understand. What we typically do on a tax credit deal, and you're going to hear this on a property that Colin Miller will talk about in a few minutes, it will be first in to secure other funding, and therefore we'll leverage our money by factors of 4, 5, 6 to 1. But it means money is in there early while the property is being developed. Housing is complicated. It is maddeningly complex. I'm in my 48th year in this business, and I'm still learning every day.
I agree with you, and that's like I said, there's a lot to learn. I will just make this closing comment. This is complicated, complex, but I think the harsh reality for everybody struggling in California and in San Diego is I look at life as there are four things that are necessities every month. It's housing, where you lay your head every day or night. There's the cost of transportation to get to and from work if you have a job, especially at a time right now where the economy's good and a lot of people are back at work. There is the issue of food and utilities. And three of them are really, really simple. Housing is the one that's most complex, but it's the one that's also, in my opinion, most important. Because even if you can't get to work, you have a place to lay your head and you're not freezing, you're not cold. And so hopefully some of the work that we can do is can help clarify the confusion in the community, because there is a lot, as you just said. And making lasagna isn't easy. Anybody's ever tried? You may only try once. but we have an obligation, I think. So thank you very much for that answer.
Thank you for humoring our crash course in all things housing and our first meeting. Also in the preserving argument, maybe could you provide an example of what a failed preservation would look like? Like, what, you know, what what's that exact problem that we're trying to solve? Like when an affordable housing is not preserved.
So an example of a failed preservation argument would be there are covenants on affordable housing, and there normally is a term on it as well. So let's say there's a 30-year term on it. Now the 30 years are coming up, and the property owner now decides he or she does not want to continue as an affordable houser. So that would be an example of a failed one. If we or anybody, if the community does not step in, then they can technically raise the rent a lot higher than the 30% or 50% or 80% that they have to do because they were in affordable housing. So once the covenants expire, and as time goes on, you'll see more and more of these covenants expiring, they have an option either to renew or to just go to the market. So that would be an example of a failed one, if they go to the market.
Sticking with the preservation thing, and that kind of clarified part of what I was about to ask. But so this whole issue of preservation came up because we had a few large projects that the term expired and they converted to market. And that's what started this whole thing a while back, if I recall correctly. So my question, as you're talking about preservation, that I need a little bit of clarity on is, so we are focusing resources towards making sure that whenever possible, we are extending those terms to keep those units affordable. What I wasn't clear on is, are those resources also applied to unrestricted units, for example, like in the SRO space where they are not deed restricted, however, they are naturally occurring affordable. So that way I wasn't quite clear whether we're viewing preservation as the broader affordable or the like narrow technical affordable.
The answer is yes to all the above. We also have another major policy piece going on that Sue Katz gotten up in formulation stage now. A new SRO policy. It's a subset of preservation, but it's important and distinct and separate enough. We're doing a separate policy statement on it. It also promised George that it'll be done by the end of this fiscal year. And that's going to try to make sense of our current SRO policy. And I think that's something that where there's a problem just the opposite of what you might think. Those SROs were set up years ago, restricted on incomes, no subsidy. And you can imagine what's happened without enough money to feed into the properties. There are some, even the ones that have not gone away, are in need of attention. And there's no funding to do that with. So we're trying to focus on that as an issue as well. And
before you, you said there's no funding for it, is because I've seen I see the dilapidated views of those properties. Does the city approach the owners of those units, of those buildings, and have conversations with them about, look, the facility, the building itself is vital to our housing population, and we'd like to know what you need to improve the situation. Is that a conversation that ever occurs? I mean, because you don't control them, but we know that they exist and they provide a valuable resource.
In broad terms, no. I think the term, I think, in the city of looking at the properties is code enforcement, making sure they're decent, safe, and habitable.
Exactly.
But there's nothing that would require an owner to fix it up, just shut it down. And then that produces another set of issues and problems. And if you fix it up, how do you pay for it? And do you increase rents to pay for it? You look for a subsidy source to pay for it. And so, again, it's one of those things where it's not an algebraic equation. It's a differential calculus. Looking at the different factors involved.
True. I just, you know, we have to use creative financing in so many spaces in business. And it would just seem that if city code enforcement saw a few properties and said, look, you know, there's a way where we're going to give you an upfront cash infusion to repair and make livable. And then there's going to be a payback over the course of time. That also adds to the preservation aspect. If I give, you know, Ryan, you know, $40,000 to fix up units, and I say, listen, you're going to pay this back over 10 years, then I've locked in that preservation for 10 years for certain because he's paying me back, but I've also improved the housing situation.
And we have done that exactly in a number of circumstances where we've had the opportunities to do so. And when Colin's up in a minute to talk about the other property, I'm going to ask you to talk about the yes, if you would please, on how we did that. We're looking at things in a creative fashion. And just two other brief comments, Madam Chair, and I'll shut up. The acronym NOAA, Naturally Occurring Affordable Housing, is a good one. And what happens with NOAA properties is that when gentrification occurs, and that doesn't mean hiring your current executive CEO here, but when gentrification occurs, that can kick up the cost so that the previous occupants cannot afford it. So what we try to do is NOAA, deal with NOAA without the gentrification involved. The other one is where to put our limited resources and what has priority. And again, it's not a matter of this is a good thing to do or not to do. It is of all the panoply of things to do and this amount of money, how do we choose? And that becomes policy making that this board can be involved in.
Great. I want to talk to you offline about, you know, ways to create full pools. We take in a tremendous amount of money for inclusionary or for in lieu monies. And I've always wondered why you can't take a portion of that in lieu money, create a revolving fund that can be used to fix up properties and make them inhabitable. I do think that it's one thing to have a roof over your head, and it's another thing if the building's falling down around you when you're trying to sleep. Not necessarily comforting. I mean, you may be out of the sheltered from the wind and the cold, but again, there may be some things that we can talk about, and I think that we really should be creative around this on the preservation side. Losing, I've been in the city long enough to see the loss of these SROs, and it's a tragedy. But if you can get them fixed up and lock them in for longer periods as far as the preservation focus, that's a benefit. So
I'm going to set a record on an item here. I'm also very interested in this, and I would just throw out for our new commissioners too that a few months back we approved a substantial amount of money for, I think it was Hotel Churchill, which was an SRO that the commission had acquired, and we all approved it. I mean, it needed the work, but we had a lot of questions at the time because this was, I think, the third tranche of major funding that went into it. And so one of the things that I think I didn't quite realize until I started seeing those things was, one of the challenges with the SROs in particular, and I'm sure that you guys are addressing this as you come up with the policy, is just they have the ability to be extremely expensive to work on. And so I think that, hopefully, my request on the policy work that's being done on this, and I think this is the approach that is being taken, is that we're weighing those things, because if we have to spend $5 million dealing with a flooding issue on an SRO in order to keep it affordable, we have to weigh that against how far that $5,000 or that $5 million goes on new inventory or purchasing something else or a different type of rehab. And those are all tough questions. But I think we're all very focused on the, beyond the scope of the regular properties, out into the NOAA realm too. So.
Okay. At the risk of prolonging all of this, because I think the general consensus is that moving to work is a huge asset for this agency in particular. What I find very valuable about it is that most of the commissioners, if not all, probably agree that while regulatory frameworks are always put in place with the most beneficial sort of intention, right, always the most noble idea about doing the right thing, what often happens is we create a very rigid box that doesn't take into consideration the realities in which the people that we're trying to serve live. And so I've always enjoyed that moving to work takes the components of someone's life and the holistic realities that they're dealing with and the various makeups that a family and a household can look like and provides ways to relieve some of the pressure that exists because of well-intentioned but kind of not really working frameworks. And so I just want to applaud staff's ability to find those spaces to relieve that pressure every year. You demonstrate a lot of innovation, a lot of creativity, and a lot of humanity when you do that, because I'm always impressed that this staff in particular does such an excellent job finding, you must be taking real feedback from our various clients and finding the ways to say, you know what, this just isn't working. We're not incentivizing the right things and we're penalizing things that otherwise we should be celebrating, because we do have an exceptional staff that work with exceptional clientele. And I'm just very proud of that. And I hope that HUD listens to your variety of suggestions, because if they work for Moving to Work, they should probably work for all agencies. But I don't want to tell anybody what to do. I would maybe suggest that because of the recent attention paid to the in-lieu fee, its use, and the ongoing confusion, because it is convoluted, and, you know, four articles in a paper is never going to do it justice, especially for the folks who are charged with really understanding that, perhaps we could schedule a workshop in the near future and allow commissioners new and old — I always benefit from these workshops — to really just ask the questions about what does this bucket do and how are we sure that this bucket is doing what we said it does. I have all the faith in the world that it does, but just give us an opportunity to poke at it, if you don't mind. Okay, fabulous. That was easy. So we do have to vote on the Moving to Work annual plan, unless there is any final comment from my fellow commissioners. No. Oh, we have a motion by Commissioner Davis, seconded by Commissioner Klumpner. All those in favor? Any opposed? Motion carries. Wonderful. Thank you, commissioners, for your robust interest in this. I think this is very promising. Next, item 102, the loan recommendation and preliminary bond authorization for Ventana Al Sur Apartments. And I am sure that Collins is chomping at the bit to say lasagna financing some more. Your eyes lit up.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Colin Miller. I'm the Vice President of Multifamily Housing Finance. I'm joined by Joe Correa, Senior Real Estate Project Manager for Multifamily. And yes, Chair Benvenuto, I do enjoy lasagna. I'd like to just address some of the comments on Island and J Street and give some a brief history of that project, as that was mentioned in the last presentation. So for the Island and J Street properties, these properties are owned by a market rate for-profit developer that had affordability restrictions that were expiring. The two properties totaled about 421 units. They are SRO units. And with the restrictions of expiring, there was an opportunity for these to go to market. And if that were to happen, you'd have 420-some people who could have their rents raised and potentially be out of housing. And so we were fortunate to enter into negotiations with the owners of those properties and to negotiate a loan. As to Commissioner Mitchell's question, we were able to negotiate a loan on both projects with the owners and extend the affordability for a number of years on both those projects. So I think the total loan amount was right around $5 million. And so for $5 million, we've preserved over 420 units. And we couldn't build that number of units that quickly. In the amount of time it takes to close a loan versus build 420 units. So that was a great opportunity for us, and it's showing when preservation does work and what we've been able to do. Any other questions on that?
I'd ask Colin to address that comment, Mitch, just to make sure, you know, we are already looking at that as a number of the issues we do, but it's a brand new effort we've done in the last year. So we're looking at every option available to us going forward.
See, you know, in the write-up, you know, that one of them, 55 years affordable for 55 years, what it said, and it just piqued my interest. I think that there would be great comfort if at some point we can get an overview of how many units are locked in for 25 years or more, because that gives us a starting point to watch, where we know that, okay, 25 years of housing that's protected. And we're adding to that stock. So I commend you on how you handle this.
Yeah, we'd be happy to provide that.
Okay.
With that, since Chair Benvenu mentioned lasagna and my level of lasagna, I'd like to give you a little kind of an overview of how the affordable housing finance works and how the commission plays a role in that. So the developers must apply to federal, state, county, and local sources to assemble all of the funding they need. And so when you think about lasagna, there's a number of ingredients and a number of like layers, and we see that if you look at the capital stack, so you have your loan, you have the commission's loan, and then all these other funding sources, it does tend to look like, you know, my favorite food. The commission is providing a loan or provides capital. They also provide operating subsidy in the form of the Section 8 vouchers. So those two items help fund the cost of constructing the property as well as the operations of the property. And one of the things to note when you look at the capital stack or in our reports, you'll see a funding summary. Most of the time, the Housing Commission's commitment is the first funding commitment that's made. And our funding commitment being made first kind of serves as the catalyst for the other funders. Developers can then include in their applications for funding to the county or to the state that the Housing Commission has committed our money to the deal. Rick mentioned that our funds go in first, and by doing so, it gives the developers a competitive advantage when making applications to the state or county. And so with that in mind, that's one of the things that's kind of so important for that. So in the case of Ventana Storage, the project you'll hear today, we're looking there. They're going to request tax exempt bonds and credits, a low interest loan from the Housing Commission, as well as vouchers, and then they will be applying to the state and contributing their own equity. So the financing gets pretty layered pretty quickly on these deals. I'm happy to answer any questions about kind of the general nature of what we do at this time, or I can turn it over to Joe, and Joe can give you a detailed presentation on the project. Not seeing any questions, Joe?
Good morning, commissioners. This item is the loan recommendation and preliminary bond authorization for Ventana El Sur Apartments. The recommendations are first that the Housing Commission Board will approve a residual receipts loan of up to $4.4 million to 4132 Buyer LP to facilitate the proposed acquisition and new construction of 101 units multifamily rental housing development to be located at 4132 Buyer Boulevard, that's in San Ysidro. The development will include 75 units for low-income seniors, plus an additional 25 units for chronically homeless seniors, age 65 plus, and homeless seniors with a serious mental illness residing in the city of San Diego who meet certain income criteria and who are identified as most appropriate for permanent supportive housing, as determined by assessments conducted through the coordinated entry system. The units will be affordable 55 years. The proposed $4.4 million maximum housing commission loan may not increase. The loan will be contingent upon the developer receiving all necessary third-party funding. The second recommendation is the Housing Authority will approve certain initial steps to issue $25 million, up to $25 million, in tax-exempt multifamily housing revenue bonds, including procedural steps of issuing a bond inducement resolution, authorizing a bond allocation application to the California Debt Limit Allocation Committee, that's CIDLAC, approving a bond counsel, which in this case is Quentin Thimmig, and a financial advisor, Ross Financial. The bond final approval is required by both the Housing Commission and Housing Authority. If the developer is successful in obtaining these third-party sources of funding, we would come back to you and back to the Housing Authority for your final review and consideration of approving the bonds. The third recommendation is authorizing the Housing Commission's president and CEO to execute documents, adjust financing terms, substitute funding sources, and take actions necessary, convenient, and or appropriate with, of course, the General Counsel's advice. Also, there's a recommendation for the City Council to hold an Internal Revenue Service required Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act hearing that is required by IRS rules, which oversee all the bond taxes and bond actions. The development, this project is proposing new construction of 101 units. 100 of those, excuse me, are affordable. 80 are one-bedroom units, 20 are two-bedroom units, and one unrestricted manager's unit. The development is supported by Housing for San Diego. That is the Housing Commission's Homelessness Action Plan. There are development details summarized at Table 1, page 3 of the report. Co-developers are the nonprofit Metropolitan Area Advisory Committee on Anti-Poverty of San Diego County, also known as MAC, and the nonprofit Kingdom Development. Both these entities are experienced, both have previously obtained Housing Commission loans, and they've successfully implemented them. There's a development team summary at Table 2, page 6 of the report. In response to the Housing Commission's permanent supportive housing, NOFA, the co-developers are requesting Housing Commission residuals loan of up to $4.4 million, Housing Authority issuance of up to $25 million of taxes at multifamily housing revenue bonds, the Housing Commission staff has provided a preliminary recommended award for 25 federal project-based housing vouchers. In effect, the vouchers are a rent subsidy to the tenants. If both the Housing Commission and Housing Authority approve today's proposed actions, then the co-developers will next be applying to the California Deadline Allocation Committee for a tax debt bonds allocation and apply to the Tax Credit Allocation Committee for a 4% tax credit allocation. Here's a map, shows you roughly where it is. It's two parcels. This is roughly located in San Ysidro, bounded south of 905, west of 805, and in the triangle there, the forest, I-5 on the west, 805 on the east, 905 on the north, San Ysidro development. Estimated sources and uses are summarized in Table 3, page 6 of the report. Estimated total development cost is $49,757,579. That's $492,649 per unit. The Housing Commission's $4.4 million loan, in effect, would leverage against about $45.3 million of other sources. That's about 10.3 times leverage of your $4.4 million, which is very good. Project costs will include prevailing wage rates because of the use of vouchers. The vouchers trigger prevailing wage rates. We have no choice in that. It's a federal requirement. The co-developers have applied for a $20 million loan from the State of California Housing and Community Development Department's Multifamily Housing Program, and that is one of the stack of lasagna sources that are included in the proposed sources. The proposed project will require demolishing one existing single-family rental unit. There is one tenant who will have to be permanently relocated. There's a summary of Table 4 with key performance indicators at page 7, and there's a summary of Table 5 that shows you how this stacks up on comparable development projects, also at page 7. Affordability.
I'm going to just real quick. You mentioned that one tenant will have to be permanently relocated.
Yes, sir.
What does that mean?
Well, there is currently a resident in one of the existing structure, and they would receive relocation benefits to be relocated under federal law.
Somewhere in the area, somewhere?
Well, let me have the developer speak to that. They've done a comprehensive analysis of that.
Let me do a quick one. That's because they're over income, right?
Right.
It's because one family's over the income limits for the project, so they can't receive the subsidy, benefits of the subsidy, but they can be relocated with certain benefits elsewhere. Chuck, is that correct?
Absolutely. And in addition, depending upon the source of funds, if we're using local funds, the state relocation law triggers. We're using federal funds, the federal relocation law triggers. And that includes doing an analysis of comparable housing in the general area and giving, and we've generally, there's a relocation consultant that's retained to do that, and they help the tenant relocate into a different unit, and they're paid 42 months worth of rent to make up or the difference between the amount of rent they were paying and the amount that they have to pay as a result of the move.
Well, there's one family. I don't know the specific number. I can ask the developer to speak to how many humans that entails. We'll have him speak as soon as we're finished. Turn myself off. The affordability. The affordability range from 20% to 50% of area median income, and we summarize affordability at Table 6, page 9 of the report. Development estimated timeline at page 9 of the report. If you approve today's proposal, we would then move on to the Housing Authority for consideration of preliminary bond authorization on March 17th. The developer would then apply for tax credits and for bond allocation on March 20th. The state committees would then hold approval meetings on May 20th. We would then return to you if they are successful at those meetings in obtaining allocations. We'd return to you probably in June for your final review and consideration of whether to go forward. We could then, if you say yes at that time, estimated construction start would be June of 2020. We would complete construction estimated June of 2021. Bond issuance summary. Proposed housing authority issuance for up to $25 million in tax-exempt bonds. The developer is responsible for paying all costs of the bond financing. The issuance is pursuant to the Housing Commission's bond policy. The bonds do not financially obligate the city, nor the Housing Authority, nor the Housing Commission. And the bonds do not pledge either full faith and credit, nor the taxing power of the city, nor full faith and credit of the Housing Authority or pledged to pay the bonds. These bonds are not what we normally think of when we think of bonds. They're not corporate bonds, sort of what you see on the stock market channels. They're not general obligation bonds. They're what's called private activity bonds, and it's a special category designated by IRS. Tax exempt because the bond purchasers do not have to pay taxes on interest payments they receive. So they're willing to accept lower interest rate payments for the tax exempt bonds because of the tax savings that they receive. I have with us today a representative from the developers, and let me throw it open for questions.
Did we have one more, or is this just the...
Just a site layout. It shows you what it will look like. We don't have an artist rendering, but we do have this.
Excellent. Thank you. I think we should probably go ahead and get started with the developer representative. Is there someone from MAC that we could talk to regarding relocation? Kingdom. I'm sorry. Kingdom also. So perhaps what might be useful is if you could just walk us through what the relocation process for anybody currently on site looks like, and then quite specifically what the permanent relocation process would be.
Sure. The best of my ability, I will explain that in my understanding. With all the deals that we do, very similar to what Christensen had said, is that a relocation consultant is engaged at this stage in development. We have not yet gone to the, or we are in the process of going to the other layers for the lasagna. And so we do appreciate your guys' consideration of this award. But at this stage in the development, a preliminary relocation plan is prepared. The consultant has not yet been engaged to do the final one that's necessary for closing and all the other things for the financing sources. So what would happen is that we would engage the appropriate party to draft up the legal requirements that the developer has to follow. This being I believe it's a single individual that lives and resides in the two-bedroom single-family home that's there in any case. And we would engage the consultant to draft up a plan that we would follow in accordance with all the relocation laws. And that includes having an appropriate budget that's estimated by the relocation consultant, considering the market area and the needs of the individual. And then it's the developer's responsibility to follow that plan in accordance with all the monitoring that San Diego Housing Commission has and the other state agencies has for that. And that's the process that would happen, that will happen for this, and where we are in the stage of it. If that answers the relocation question.
That helps. I have another question. Mm-hmm. So estimated start of construction work would be June 2020. The individual or family that is currently on site that would need to be relocated would need to be relocated within months, correct? If we're starting, we're not going to construct with them on site.
Yes, correct. It would be accomplished before.
So has there been engagement with that family or individual at this point?
Yes, the appropriate general information notices have been issued to them. They've been received and understood, accepted, and everything necessary has, you know, happened up to this point for it to be the most expeditious and within law requirements to do that in the appropriate time.
Good. I think within law is a nice baseline. I think what we're very curious about and what the fellow commissioners were trying to get at is if there's really proactive engagement of that family. Housing Commission staff has historically been very good with relocation. It's always been a hot topic from the commissioners. I just want to make sure that it's not, here's your paperwork,
Yes. You've
received it. You can see the sensitivity there.
Absolutely, yeah.
Commissioner Hester?
Do we know how long the resident will do
don't have it offhand. I believe it's been several years. I believe they've been there for a while.
The reason why I brought it up is A, when reading the material and listening to you, when you said there was one tenant, I do think that it is important, as the chairwoman said, that we handle any situation like this in the most respectful manner, with a focus on customer satisfaction, right? Yeah. That's why I said relocation within the area. We don't know whether the life that the current tenant has really it revolves around being in that specific space. And as the chairwoman said, it's really important to me that we not just say, hey, listen, here's your new address. There's a truck that's going to be there to move you on Wednesday. Thank you for your patience. I mean, that's, you know, so.
Well, if I can address some of that, one great thing that we have within the development team is Mac is, a community established great presence that they've done a lot. And one of the benefits that Mac is that they are a property management company within their company, and they have a huge heart for the area. The president grew up in that area. And so one of the benefits that the development team has is that, you know, they do care, and we do everything that we can to make sure that we're not only law but courteous. And we unfortunately, due to this length of time that these things take, we acquired the property in January 2018. That's when the beginning of notifications happened. So this is not anything new. Surprising, Mac is managing the property, and they keep them up to date with all the information that we're doing and developing. And so it's beyond just here's your paperwork, but they are for years now have been in the know about where we are and how this is going.
Let me add that as with our other projects, the developers are required to engage a third-party relocation consultant, and that consultant coordinates a relocation plan, works closely with the family, manages the relocation process, and assists the tenant, and assists with all the required federal noticing. So it's not going to come as a surprise. We're not going to be given a bus ticket and saying goodbye, see you tomorrow. The relocation consultant, a third-party consultant who is expert in the field, will assist the tenant.
Just on that,
mm-hmm.
Is there any question?
Thank you. Just on that comment, I love our tagline, we are about people. And I think that's what this Board of Commissioners are really expressing. So I appreciate that. My question on the property, it is 100% 100 unit multifamily rental housing. 75 of the units are for low income seniors, 25 for chronically homeless seniors and homeless seniors with mental illness. Are there services in the building that's going to be provided, or is that off site? Or how does that look like for the building?
We have a robust intensive case management for the supportive service, permanent supportive housing units for the homeless. And we're very excited to partner with Father Joe's. Their name has come up a lot today. They do a lot of things in the area. They're a wonderful partner that we have on the deal. And they're going to bring incredible services to the 25 units of permanent supportive housing. Also, Mac being having the heart that they do in the community, they are also a service provider for the social services that they're going to provide to 100% of the seniors. So not only the 75% non-permanent supportive housing, but for also the 25%. So there will be plenty of services. We have a robust budget for it.
On-site.
Everything is on-site, and there are some benefits that Father Joe's provides to all of the permanent supportive housing units in their headquarters, which is not across the street, but they do help provide transportation to it for really specialty things. So we're really excited about the service that are going to be, and most of it, or all of it, is going to be on site.
Correct me if I'm wrong, you said that the Kingdom acquired the property in January of 2018?
The partnership borrower, the resulting partnership acquired the property.
And I imagine that the loan property owner was probably notified of the change of ownership shortly thereafter?
What was the question?
The property owner was probably notified of the change of ownership. The plans.
The change of ownership, right, the plans, right. Yeah. That's when the beginning information notices go out.
And construction is slated to be completed in June of this year?
No, it started.
2021, thank you. Oh, yeah, that'd be lightning quick, thank you. That's it, thank you.
Thank you. I would just like to, I haven't been on this board that long, but we've had lines of people out the door before on market rate projects where they're being displaced. And the best we can say is we'll allocate some emergency funding to help them, or, unfortunately, they have to go on a years-long wait list to qualify. However, I don't think that we've had a single resident come complain about a relocation on an affordable project. And so I know that that's always a concern of ours. I trust that that will be handled and that we will keep that up, because I am much more concerned about the people that we have to refer to a wait list because we don't have an option for them than I am that any of our partners would mess up the relocation. So I trust that you'll handle that properly. Really like 100 units. This is a vulnerable population. The seniors with mental health issues. We just did the point time count. We've all seen how desperate these situations are. Appreciate it. Love the 10-to-1 leveraging. Fantastic use of our dollars here. I would like to move that we accept.
Okay.
Make a motion. Motion to approve.
Okay, we'll go ahead and pause the motion for a question from Commissioner Hubbard.
Yes, it's actually a question about the bond. I forgot what the name is, but you were saying, John, that it's a new bond that's being issued. It has ties with the IRS. Is it a new bond, period, or is it just a new bond that's being offered to us or the developer?
Thank you. So the way the bond program works, the state of California, and I'll try not to get too far in the weeds on this, the state of California is given an allocation of bonds for the entire state. The developer will apply to the state for bonds. The bonds, if awarded, are secured. The repayment of the bonds, that repayment is secured by the property's revenue. When Joe mentions the IRS, there's the low-income housing tax credit program, which is part of the tax code. And so a developer works with an investor to sell the bonds. They get tax credits in return, and an investor gets to write off a portion of their taxes for 10 years in return for giving equity to the developer to build the building. I know it sounds complicated. We probably need to have an Affordable Housing 101 next month, yeah. So long story short, they're not new bonds. They're bonds issued from the state, that come from the state. But they're not issued by the city. That's the differentiation I think they were trying to make. They're issued by the housing authority, but they come from the state.
Thank you. So we have a motion. We have a second now by Commissioner Mitchell. Any further discussion? All those in favor? Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. I believe that takes us through all of our action items and brings us to our workshop and discussion on the real estate portfolio.
All right. Good morning, commissioners. I'm Emily Jacobs, Senior Vice President of Housing Finance and Property Management. And with me today is Mike Pafko, Senior Vice President of Real Estate Development and Portfolio Management. Today, we're going to be walking you through the Housing Commission's real estate portfolio, a very high-level presentation. And we have staff on hand as well as us to answer any questions after the presentation. little bit about the Housing Commission. The Housing Commission provides affordable, safe, and quality homes for low and moderate income families and individuals in the city of San Diego. At present, we have over 3,700 affordable rental units that we own and manage, including our nonprofit affiliate, Housing Development Partners. A little bit about the diversity of our portfolio. We have multifamily housing, permanent supportive housing, single room occupancy housing, public housing, single family homes. We administer ground leases both for the commission and the city of San Diego. We have Smart Corner, which you're in right now, and commercial spaces. This slide shows the reach that we have geographically. We go as far as La Jolla to the north, to the border of La Mesa to the west, or to the east, excuse me, to downtown with the west, and all the way to San Ysidro in the south. This speaks to our types of properties we have. We have a total of 169 locations comprised of over 3,700 apartments, and you can see the variety in unit types there, SRO all the way to five bedrooms. And we also navigate various programs such as public housing, the low-income housing tax credit, which has a front and back end implication, the multifamily housing revenue bonds, project-based vouchers, as well as the home program. We're going to walk through a sampling of some of our assets. This is the Hotel Churchill, as Rick had mentioned, right outside the window here. It's in downtown San Diego and provides 72 units of supportive housing. This is our property, one of our properties to the north, La Jolla Marine. It's eight affordable townhomes with wonderful views of La Jolla Cove nearby and was recently renovated. I'm very proud of this property and all of our properties. This is Otay Villas in Otay Mesa West, and this is 77 affordable apartments. This is one of our flagships, San Diego Square, also right outside the window here, 154 affordable apartments for seniors. This is our Ruby Award-winning Rehab of the Year Town and Country, located in the Mountain View neighborhood, 143 affordable apartments that is comprised of actual preservation and new production. This is University Canyon in the Linda Vista neighborhood, 120 affordable apartments. And with that, Mike will take the rest.
Great. Thank you, Emily, and good morning, commissioners. As mentioned previously, the Housing Commission owns and operates over 3,700 units of housing, and our real estate operations department directly oversees the asset management and property management of those units. And to oversee the geographically dispersed portfolio, we have four regional hub offices in the north, east, south, and west. We also have six additional management offices. We have 15 operational teams that consist of property managers and maintenance techs. And we also oversee third-party property management companies for the Housing Development Partners portfolio. And to the left there, that's a picture of the Hotel Sanford on Fifth Avenue, and it is 129 units of senior housing located in the downtown area. Okay, so next we have a video clip of one of our residents from our Belden property that really helps to highlight the impact that our portfolio has on our residents.
I was in North Park, and I lived there for 9 years. What ended up happening was they upped my rent, and I had a really good job. I was the manager of a restaurant and in Del Mar, but I got sick and I got cancer, so it changed my life, and I had to it completely changed my life, where I couldn't work anymore and I wasn't making the money, and I went, okay, this is not working for me. I can't afford it. Something has to change. And so when this opportunity came up, it was like, it just was like, the perfect thing. I'm very grateful that I can afford this. Because if I didn't have affordable housing, I would be homeless. Literally. I don't know where I would be. I love my apartment. I love where I'm at. I love my location. I work as a chef, and even though I can't do long hours, my executive chefs know that, you know, I'm very limited, but they give me my hours, and I'm on my feet. So I thank the San Diego Housing Commission for allowing me to, oh my gosh, I'm going to cry again, for allowing me to have the opportunity to have the choice of having a place to live and being able to then step into another career and putting the two together and being able to still be alive and be happy and do this. So thank you. I really appreciate it.
So we're particularly proud of our housing, but also that we get to offer a wide variety of supportive services for our residents. We have a number of permanent supportive housing projects, senior housing, and a lot of great services that go along with it. The highest level of supportive services is offered at our PSH projects, and that includes comprehensive case management services, mental health services, substance abuse counseling, financial literacy, health and nutrition. We really try to provide a wide spectrum and to appeal to as many of our residents as possible. So finally, our real estate development department is the group responsible for preserving the Housing Commission's assets, and we do so through a green physical needs assessment that was portfolio-wide to really understand what the capital needs are of our portfolio over time. So we've been systematically repairing each of the properties, kind of going one by one and doing comprehensive renovations of all the 3,700 units. We wanted just to highlight one of our properties, our Gulf Crest housing development in San Carlos is a before and after picture. But we also have a sort of an aerial flyover video that we're going to show that takes you through what the development looked like after our renovation. So we're very active in the market and acquiring new properties. So we're going to be excited to bring new projects before this board for you to hear, and then to also bring forward our capital plan for the renovations of the projects for the upcoming year. And that concludes our presentation, but we're more than happy to answer any questions and open it up to comments.
If I could, just a couple of other comments to put it in perspective. Again, heavily for the newbies. The Housing Commission has four major lines of business and then a fifth, which is a series of boutique programs. One major line of business is the Section 8 Housing Choice Voucher Program. You saw a brief presentation on that by Suket and folks a little bit ago, and that's our voucher program where we serve over 15,000 families. The second is the properties that we finance that are third-party owned and operated. It will do a major, that's where the creative finance comes in. And we'll have an in-depth presentation on that at a workshop next month. Third line of business is this one, the properties that we own and operate. Fourth line of business is our homelessness programs. which is a new line. We did not exist when I got here 12 years ago. We've basically grown it over the last 10 years or so and is a major function for us now. Then there's a fifth set of smaller boutique-y programs, including a home ownership program, and other programs. And Madam Chair, what we'll plan to do as staff maybe is a workshop on each of those going forward each month until we get through the five, now that we've got what I believe is going to be an intact board for some time. With respect to the real estate portfolio, every single one of our properties is Google mapped and on the website. And I don't really know of one other housing agency in the whole country that had the guts to do that. So if you want to see our property, go online. If you want to visit it, you'll know where it is. If you want us to meet you there from staff, we'll be there. You tell us when and where. I'll point out, too, that every one of our properties is in good shape. We've got nothing that's dilapidated or in trouble. I will reiterate something Mike said a minute ago about our green needs assessment, which we did, I believe, 2-3 years ago. And now we're rolling through our inventory to make sure those properties are in good shape going forward for a number of years. Wanted to make sure that, again, because of the diversity of what we've got, and because you literally cannot differentiate our properties from the neighborhood around it, except in some cases our properties are the best. To know what's out there, to know the dispersion of it, and Madam Chair, we'd be glad to respond to any questions you all might have.
From any other commissioners?
Oh, just when we have the workshop, I'd like to know more about, you know, in a perfect world, you have 3,732 units. How many would you like to have in over the course of the next 5 years?
Tell you how many I'd like to have, that's easy. How many we're going to have, well, it's a little bit more difficult. Generally, I like to differentiate between two different but related issues. One is affordable housing for the poor, and the other is housing affordability for everybody else, except maybe the very wealthy, but they don't have any problems. There is a certain percentage of the population in every community in the country that cannot make it on their own. It doesn't matter to me whether it's a high-cost area like San Diego or San Francisco, or whether it's a low-cost area like Tulsa, Oklahoma, you mentioned Oklahoma a while ago, or Pascagoula, Mississippi, or Laurinburg, North Carolina, where you've got low prices, you typically got low income as well. And there's going to be a certain percentage of the population, I think around 10-15%, say 30% of median and below, they're always going to need help. So I think that if you extrapolate those numbers into San Diego's population, that'd give you a fair example. Now, what we need going forward is going to depend on several issues, because I think, as I said a while ago, we're dealing with the aftermath of 30 to 40 years of inadequate public policy nationally, statewide, and citywide. With respect to affordable housing, that is, with respect to housing affordability for the middle class, working class, everybody else, I think that's heavily a matter of supply. We don't have a supply keeping up with need, with the demand, and when that happens, you get a rapid price appreciation, and that's what's happened to the whole West Coast. And that's a matter of supply. And I think if you go back a dozen years ago to the Great Recession, which was a real estate-led recession, biggest problem when I got here in 08 was not homelessness. It was foreclosures. The market's absorbed those and gone beyond it and has created a great need. And we've lost development capacity. Neighbors do not want to see additions to the neighborhoods, as Mr. Klumpner said a while ago. So I think we've got to have more permissive development schemes, as the mayor, to his credit, has been addressing over the last few years going forward for everybody. And I think if you can lower the price burden, then you lower the number of people that affordable housing affects. However, even in a perfect world, in an affordable community, you're still going to have the poor who need our help, always need our help. And I think that's where you – and also one other thing I think is significant. I saw an article in the Wall Street Journal last month that basically posited about a third of the economic growth in this country right now is coming out of 16 counties in the whole country, 16 urban counties. heavily the West Coast, mainly California, Texas, Florida, and spots in between, like, say, Charlotte, Nashville, Denver, the urban Northeast as well. If you overlay that map on the map where the homeless problem is the worst, you get basically the same places. We got great economic growth. Housing's not keeping up. It's pushing up prices, spitting out people in the worst circumstances on the bottom. So it's going to take, I think, a concerted effort, not just by the Housing Commission, but by city and state leadership as well, to permit more housing. And I'd like to see more subsidies, whereas I've not seen an increase in subsidy levels now going back about 25 years.
Any other commissioner comments or questions? I have one quick one. One thing that the commission does well is identifying properties under HDP from which to develop. I too saw an article recently, but it was talking about the genius in renovating motels for affordable housing, which you guys have done well and for a while. So could you talk a little bit about what your strategy is going forward to identify spaces for HDP to develop, how you do that now, what those successes have been?
Yeah, thank you. This is a topic near and dear to our heart. So, yeah, we've made a substantial business out of renovating motels and hotels over the last 6 or 7 years, including the Hotel Sanford, the Hotel Churchill, Quality Inn, West Park, New Palace, the Mason Hotel. There's been a long list of them. And, you know, one of the major goals is to try to get individuals that are homeless off the street as quickly as possible. And we know that new construction takes a long time to develop. It can take years by the time you get through entitlements and you get through new construction to actually have new units for people to move into. Additionally, we know the rental housing market is extremely tight. So if you're to buy an apartment complex, it's likely that those are occupied, really not creating new housing opportunities. So we've been looking at the hotel motels for a number of years. It's a difficult business. Oftentimes you're having to transform a unit. We add kitchenettes. In the case of Hotel Churchill, we added individual baths and kitchens to really make them livable spaces. But I think our greatest success has been working with brokers that have had an ability to find off-market transactions so that we can negotiate one-on-one, get the best prices, and then to bring them for this board and hopefully develop them. So, yeah, we're hoping to continue to do that. Like I mentioned before, we have a couple of properties that we kind of have in the hopper and are excited to bring them forward when they're ready.
Thank you. I just had to make that ask. It's always one of my favorite things when the commission staff go out and kind of tease out these spaces that aren't necessarily up for sale yet, and somehow we manage to turn them into viable properties for folks who desperately need them. And on that same note, and on the note that Commissioner Klumpner was making earlier, I hope that staff stay ardently committed to turning blighted spaces, underutilized spaces, spaces that are just available into affordable housing. The community will come to appreciate it if they don't yet, but I appreciate that you guys have been so steadfast in continuing to do that throughout the city. So please don't hesitate to lean on the commissioners if we can be of help in communities where the only challenge is not land, is not money, is not will. It's neighbors that don't seem to get the need. So thank you very much. But any other questions before we come to the end of this meeting? Okay, with that, I think we will adjourn. We don't need a motion to adjourn, right? I ask you that every month. All right, well then, we are adjourned. Thank you.